There can be bad language and adult concepts in this program. So please watch out for little ears if you've got your podcast playing and pop on some headphones. That way no one can get offended but you. Before we begin this episode, we'd like to take a moment's silence to pay respects to a very special person, author and screenwriter Jessie Blackadder. Jessie is an award-winning author of novels for adults and children, an amazing spirit, and a writer ambassador for Room to Read. Jessie passed away this week, and it's a huge loss. Our thoughts and feelings, hopes and wishes are with Jessie's family and loved ones. And in honour of her contribution to this world, we'd just like to take a few seconds of silence. Thank you. We hope you enjoy this episode.
It's, again, it's that discipline of saying, okay, I've written, 30,000 words on this character, but actually he only is allowed to have five.
You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we celebrate women writers, support women's rights, and talk all things women and writing. I'm Kel Butler, podcaster and wannabe author. I'm founder of Listen Up Podcasting, where we make podcasts for a positive world. Check me out at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or find me on Facebook.
And I'm Pamela Cook, author of five novels, four traditionally published and one indie release. I'm a writing teacher and a podcaster. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is available now at all online retailers and at pamelacook.com.au.
Listen to all of our episodes at www.rightsforwomen.com or subscribe wherever you get your pods.
Hi, everyone. Today on Rights for Women, we welcome Leah Swan. Leah is a journalist, a speechwriter, and author of the recently released literary crime thriller Shearwater. She's had numerous short stories and essays published in journals and anthologies and won the Overland Short Story Prize for her fiction, That Inward Eye. Leah has also written a highly acclaimed fantasy series for middle graders, The Ragna Trilogy. Today we're going to be talking to Leah about her debut novel, Shearwater, which has been receiving rave reviews and is a gripping, beautifully written thriller which has you turning pages as it hurtles towards its nail-biting climax. So Leah, I really, really enjoyed Shearwater, and I'm really excited to speak to you about it today. Welcome to Rights for Women.
Oh, thanks so much, Pamela. It's great to be here, and I'm so glad to hear you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it really was a page-turner and just so beautifully written. Your prose is divine, so I really enjoyed that.
Thank you. That's music to my ears. That's great. Thank you.
Before we get on to talking about that, can we go back in time a little bit, well, maybe a long way, to the moment that you first knew that you wanted to be a writer? Can you remember a particular moment or time? Tell us about that.
It was, honestly, I think it dawned on me over time. So the first thing that really stands out is being a reader, because actually what happened was my aunt bought me a copy of The Naughtiest Girl in the School when I was in grade two, I think. And it was the first time I'd ever been given a chapter book, and I read that book to death. I just couldn't believe that I could read a book and enter into another world. I was going to boarding school. I had the jam biscuits in the tin, in the little trunk. And already, even at that age, I had been telling myself stories about my dolls rather than playing with them. And it wasn't long after that that I started writing little stories of my own. And then over time, I realized that that's what I wanted to do. But there's no one particular moment. I think it was just something I was always doing, always telling myself stories, always. And the idea that one day I could write a book and give that pleasure to someone else began to crystallize it as an ambition. But there wasn't a kind of light bulb moment.
And you went into journalism as a career?
Yeah, so I didn't do a journalism course. I did an arts degree in literature and history. And I thought when I was at uni, I thought I'd be an academic. I loved it so much, especially the history. And then my boyfriend moved to Dubbo, New South Wales, and got a job there. And I thought, oh, you know, I just finished. It was the 90s. There was a recession. And so I just went to Dubbo and I got a job on the paper there. And that's how I started. And it was great. It was wonderful. I was writing stories about this amazing country, huge country town, and meeting all these fascinating characters and a completely different way of life to sort of inner city Melbourne where I'd been living.
Mm, yeah, for sure. Oh, that's a really interesting way to get into it. Yeah.
Oh, it was fantastic. You know, like going to ATMs were just being introduced, and so going to the local town of Gallagherbone, where they, you know, local businesses were up in arms because the bank was closing and they were putting in this machine. And how were they going to manage their businesses? You know, it was another world. And of course, yeah, all the farmers come into Dubbo from all around the West, you know, and places as far away as Lightning Ridge and some really mysterious outback places.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure you met some characters in that job.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Good writing fodder.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And we had the little paper that I was on had a wee column called Fascinating Folks, and so we used to interview some interesting, often quite mad character from the town, and it was great.
Sounds like a really interesting job.
It was.
And so previous to publishing Shearwater, you sort of cut your teeth, I guess, in fiction on short stories. Would that be right?
Yes. So I was I've always written short stories, just as sometimes with an idea of publication, but sometimes really just would have a couple of characters in my head and something, some little incident or something interesting that was happening. And I often found that writing something in a fictional form was a way of exploring what that was, what that is, that little sort of intranquility of spirit that you have about some particular issue. And then sort of by pursuing it and investigating it in fiction, you can learn things that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been sort of a mixture of consciousness and unconsciousness in doing that. So sometimes, so in the collection of Bearings, there's a story, Lovest Thou Me, it's called, and it's about losing someone. And it was the first time in my own life I'd lost someone I was very close to, and in this fictional form, I was able to just explore what that feels like, what grief feels like, which was not how I expected. I expected it just to be devastating and overwhelming. But actually what it does, or what I experienced, was that it sneaks up on you at different moments, and all of a sudden you feel your heart constricted with longing for this person who's gone. And it's always there. Like, you actually, as people leave your life, you know, we all experience this eventually, that there's a kind of, you know, the grief is always there a little bit, just a little bit. It's in you. It becomes part of who you are.
Yeah, yeah, that's so true. It's a really lovely way of looking at it. You know, it's a different perspective. Yeah. And I think in short stories are a really good way of examining those different perspectives, aren't they? Absolutely. And like you say, those moments in time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And often sometimes I think Kate Kennedy makes this lovely remark. She's in her stories, she loves to explore aftermath, you know, the baby's been born, or the accident has happened, and what happens afterwards to the people involved. And I think that is very interesting.
Yeah, so yeah. True. And so did that short story form come fairly naturally to you? Because it is a real art, short story writing. You know, like I'm sort of more of a long form writer myself, and I mean, I've tried my hand at short stories and I've written some, but I really struggle with that contained form, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the honest truth is that, you know, I've written short stories for a long time as a way of containing some of those things, but over the years I got better at it, because really what everyone talks about this in relation to short stories, but you know, that no word can be wasted. And, you know, there may be some really fascinating tangent about a character that you would like to explore. And in my early stories, I would go off on the tangent. But what the discipline of the short story is that you might learn something really interesting about that character, but really you can't afford to put in more than a line or even a few words about what you've discovered about that character in a short story. Whereas the novel is more forgiving in that way. Mm. It is more forgiving, but at the same time, I think your interest and a pace, even in a novel, is when you're able to sort of still condense a lot of that around a character so that the character feels very rich and alive, but you don't necessarily know every single detail about it.
Yeah, another art form. So was Shearwater your first, I know it's your first published novel, is it the first novel you've written, or were there others that are sort of in a drawer?
No, I've got at least three.
Okay.
One of them was a really dreadful one that I sent off to the Vogel years ago, which I thought was wonderful at the time. But now, you know, and it is interesting because you sort of go into them and you write them and you put everything in and you think it's pretty good. And then, you know, you read it a couple of years later and just go, oh my goodness, thank goodness that didn't get published. you know, or because there is, it's interesting what the standard is and that, and this is one of the really most, really quite a painful thing to learn as a writer, that what you're interested in, and you might be quite good at characterization and dialogue and setting, but it takes a lot for all of that to gel in a really coherent way. Mm. And you really can only learn that, or I could only really learn that through redrafting. And even Shearwater, I sent out earlier than I should have. And I would get the little knockback, you know, what I call the good knockback, like, oh, there's some interesting things here, but it's not for us. You know, and you sort of think, okay, what's not working? Something's not working. And it's that persistent, that dogged persistence into trying to find out what's not working. Why are people not engaging properly with the novel? Because one of the things is that what you're interested in as a writer may not necessarily be what the readers are interested in. And this is the gift of story, you know, that they're interested in the story. So I might be interested in, I don't know, in the case of Shearwater, the character of Simon, I might want to write about him for chapters and chapters and chapters, but nobody else is really interested. They want to know how Simon fits into the story, and the story is not about Simon in the case of Shearwater, for example. So it's about kind of, it's that discipline of saying, okay, I've written, you know, 30,000 words on this character, but actually he only is allowed to have 5 in the novel. And that's, you know, that's where that, you know, that thing, Kill Your Darlings, comes from.
Yeah. And your short story experience would come in very handy there, I'm sure.
It does. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It does. But it's still painful. Even now, it's still painful. You have those little gems and you go, I don't want to lose that scene. I worked so hard on that scene. Yeah.
Before we go any further, for people who may not have read Shearwater yet, could you give us a little synopsis of what the story's about?
Sure. So it's sort of basically it begins with Ava and a woman called Ava, and she's in the car with her two young sons, Max and Teddy, and they are on their way to a place called Shearwater, a new town, excited for a fresh start. And they're almost there. They're so excited. They're starting to relax. You don't know exactly why they need to relax, but something, Ava in particular, is very excited. And then they witness a shocking incident. They see a light plane falling from the sky into a nearby field. And even though it is the last thing Ava wants to do at that point, she pulls over to the side of the road and she feels compelled to help. Now, she is as you learn through the book, she's a trained first responder. So I think there's an aspect of her which feels professionally compelled, even though she has two little children in the car. She doesn't even really think about it, although later on it become, you know, people sort of ask her, why did you leave the children? She runs into the field. She goes to help. She leaves Max in charge of Teddy in the car and says, don't get out. I'll be back soon. And other people, you know, they turn up to help as well. And she's able to start running back to the car. But in fact, when she does get back, the boys have gone. And nobody saw them go. Nobody knows where they are. And really the story that unfolds after that is what has happened to those boys and why. And it is also about how those characters love each other and hurt each other, and really the relationships that are behind this situation. And anyone who's read reviews of Shearwater will know that it does touch on some emotional and tragic extremes. And really, there's something about this story. I mean, I actually avoided it, writing it for a long time, because losing your children, as anyone who's been in charge or had care of a child knows, if you were in charge of a child, there's nothing worse than if they get lost.
Mm.
You know, if you know, I mean, every parent knows it's their worst nightmare. But even somebody who's an uncle or aunt who's been in a crowded fairground and the child that they're in charge of goes missing, your adrenaline, everything goes up to 100. You just absolutely start panicking. And that's the situation that Ava's plunged into
at
the start of the novel. And it doesn't really let up much for her. It's told from different perspectives. And one of the reasons that I did start telling it from different perspectives is because Stava's consciousness was actually incredibly difficult.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I mean, you really tap into that, you know, as a mother. I'm just listening to you talk there. I remember a time when I lost my daughter in, I think it was SeaWorld in San Diego, and it was for about half an hour. Was gone. She was about three, and it was just, you know, I can kind of remember the feeling now, but you can never, it's hard to really capture it, but you've really tapped into that deep fear that we have, you know, as parents.
It's a terrible feeling. My daughter was three as well when she went missing, and she had three little friends over for a party, and then they all decided, we found out later, to go for an adventure.
Oh,
and
lovely.
We looked around and the three girls are gone. Where were they? And I had a big backyard, so we're looking everywhere, and then my sister, who was the mother of one of the girls, just went, I'm just going. And she went bolting down the street. And I'm thinking, they won't have gone down the street, but they had. They had walked all the way to the school on their own. Three little girls. The terror.
Yeah.
I was, you know, within 10 minutes ringing the police. It was just like, you know, it was horrendous.
Yeah. Well, you've really tapped into those emotions in Shearwater. And as you say, it does, from the moment, you know, that they go missing, there is this sort of relentless pace that is kept up, and it is a thriller style pace. Was that something that you intended, you know, when you wrote your draft type thing, or was it, did that sort of tension, you know, really come to the fore and be ramped up in your revisions?
Yeah, no, definitely the latter. In my first draft, I really focused on just unearthing the story, so writing it scene by scene. I had a rough idea of where I was going. I knew the boys were in genuine danger from the start, but I wasn't sure how it was going to play out. I wasn't sure what exactly had happened to them when I started. I knew from that first scene when I first, you know, that the way that the mother, Ava, was holding the steering wheel with such tension, that there was something going on in her life. So, and I just had to sort of uncover all of that. And it's told over 3 days now, but at that first draft, it was told over 5 days. And it was another case of kill your darlings. It was just, you know, cut out the extra time, compress the action into 3 days, so that readers really are hurtling through events alongside Ava and Max and Teddy. And I think I didn't realise this when I started, but suspense, pace does contribute to suspense a great deal. And the other thing that contributes hugely to suspense is having something that you really care about, in this case the boys, so you're invested from the start, like what is going to happen to them. And I think as a reader, I've always loved those books where you just get lost in the book. You don't want to get up and cook dinner. You just want to stay on the couch with the book, and the world vanishes and you're in that story. And I knew suspense was a way of doing that.
Mm-hmm. And the plane crash sort of is an interesting inciting incident for this story, because of course the real story is about the boys going missing and the ensuing events. So where did the sort of plane crash idea come for you, you know, as that beginning incident?
Well, really, yeah, I mean, really that whole beginning scene, well, it floated into my mind on a road trip. And I think we'd been having a conversation about a real life incident, my husband and I, about a real life incident about people rescuing children from a burning bus. And I started thinking to myself, would I have the courage to jump into a burning bus and rescue children? I don't know if I would. You know, you like to think you would. You hope you would, but I don't know. And I started thinking about that. And then I started thinking about this woman driving and seeing a plane or a bus or something on the side of the road and stopping. And that's really where it came from. And I think at some point it became a plane. I'm fairly sure that was fairly early on.
Mm, mm. And at the centre of, I guess, the novel really obviously is the boys and the missing, but behind that, as you say, the backstory to that is Ava's relationship with her husband, Lawrence,
yes,
and it's a sort of disintegrating, you know, marriage. And how was that, I guess, describing and exploring that relationship? How did you meld all the elements, I guess, of the story together? So you had that as the backdrop, and then you've got these quite dramatic incidents happening in the present time story.
Yeah.
You said you write in scenes. I guess I'm asking, what's your writing process when you're doing that?
Well, in the case of Lawrence, who's a complicated character, I knew there was tension between them, and I wasn't sure exactly how that would unfold. I knew what I wanted to explore, which was what happens in these relationships where everything does disintegrate and break down to such a point that people feel under threat by somebody that they were once in a loving relationship with. What is that? You know, like we all know from news reports, and we know from reading non-fiction books how some of this stuff happens, but fiction offers a unique kind of opportunity to sort of delve into that realm, I think. And really there is this emotional reality that exists between people, as you know, that, you know, from your own friendships, for example, that when you see such and such a friend, you'll come away feeling a certain way because there's a chemistry in that friendship. I think once, you know, I heard this, I went to a storytelling workshop once, and the teacher was talking about there's you and there's me, and then there's what rises between us. And I thought that's he said, I think the bread that rises between us. And I thought that's fascinating. And it was that I wanted to explore in the marriage, and how we can get so lost in it, and how quickly as well outsiders will judge that. Like people will say, oh, it's easy. Why doesn't she just leave him? Or why doesn't she just do this? And they'll judge it before they really enter into the complexity of what's going on.
Yeah.
In that emotional realm. And this is the stuff we talk about. This is, you know, these emotional problems that arise between people, this is what we're fascinated by. And it was that space that I wanted to look at.
Yeah, yeah, it's really interesting. And they're both very interesting characters in their own right. For a while there, as I was reading, well, I mean, I'm not going to give anything away, but you do get the impression at a few points that Ava is sort of an unreliable narrator. That's how I felt at different points.
Yeah.
And was that a deliberate sort of thing on your part?
Yeah, it was, because we all have a subjective effective. And that is true in life. And so is she, you know, when you start out, your sympathy is completely with her. But then, okay, but all right, but so what are us here? You know, when you hear from Lawrence's perspective, he has a completely different take on her actions, and he's angry because he's had, she's, you know, she's put some boundaries up around him relating to the children. She's taken an intervention order out, but which he finds completely unfair and unjust. And so how reliable is he in that rendering as well? Because when the story is told from that character's perspective, the important thing is to actually feel a connection to that character. Lawrence is a really complicated character, and I found those sections hard to write. But, you know, people do feel that they're, you know, we're all the hero of our own story. You know, we all, you know, and we all interpret other people's actions and words in particular ways according to our own inner narrative. And that's part of the complexity.
Yeah, for sure. It was really interesting. I really enjoyed those switches, you know, in point of view.
Yeah, that's great.
And
Seeing
that different perspective, you know, because like you say, your sympathies are definitely with Ava. And then when things switch, it sort of makes you question that, you know, empathy you have for that character, which again increases your desire to turn the page and find out what's happening. And do use other characters as point of view characters too, including Max, their son. How was that? They're little lovely sections written from Max's viewpoint. Did you enjoy doing that perspective?
Max is absolutely my favourite character. When I first started writing, I wasn't intending to write from his perspective at all, and yet as I began to think about him, I felt like, maybe I would like to write a little bit from his perspective. And then those scenes just wrote themselves. Okay. It was just amazing. He's such a sweetheart, and he's, you know, he's a shy, you sort of learn over time, he's a shy and indecisive sort of boy. He's sort of 9, and he has this incredible desire to do the right thing and this yearning that everything will be all right. And I think that there's a bit of Max in all of us. I think he's very relatable, because at our core we all hope that. We all hope things are going to be all right. And yeah, it was a revelation. And also just remembering what it's like as a child, how mysterious adults are. What are they, you know, what are they thinking? Why are they doing that, you know, and wanting to trust and love the parent, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. And did you, as you were, when you wrote, say, your first draft of this, or your first few couple of drafts, I imagine there was more than one.
It definitely was.
Did you write initially from multiple perspectives and then start to weave new perspectives in? How did you manage that whole process of multiple viewpoints?
I wrote from, I think, about 6 perspectives initially. Ava's mother, Vanessa, had a perspective going as well. And Simon had much more than is currently in the novel. And then what I absolutely had to do as I redrafted was to make the story the king rather than the perspective.
Right.
Because and again, you know, you feel this, you know, so I ended up cutting a Vanessa's perspective out completely. Which I think was the right choice, but it was hard because she added some really interesting perspectives on Lawrence, for example. And that all had to go.
so
it was just because it wasn't really adding to the pace of the story.
Right.
It wasn't really adding anything. I think maybe one or two things she gets a line of dialogue on something. And all of that gets compressed into that. But in a way, that's just what I had to do in order to learn that about Vanessa.
Yeah, yeah. So you had to write her to get to know her. Are you a plotter? Do you plot, or are you sort of more of a pantser?
Exactly, the latter. Because the fun of it for me is in the discovery. So while I do have an idea of where I'm going, I knew that the children would be taken. I knew roughly who had probably taken them, and I knew that Ava would do everything in her power to get them back. Everything that she would pull no stops. But I knew I wanted to have it set on the Great Ocean Road. And I knew I wanted it not to be overly violent, but it's interesting, the story, at a certain point, the story just takes over and takes you to places that you don't expect. And that's the exciting bit. When you come up from the study and you've gone to a place you didn't expect. And when I'm not doing that, when I'm trying to do it plot by point by plot point, all the fun of it just goes out of it.
Yeah.
And let's face it, as writers, we don't do it for the money. We do it for the love of it.
True.
We do it for the joy of it. And so what's the point in writing something too strictly to the point that you're not having fun anymore?
So
definitely, it's definitely, I will just write the scene and see where it takes me. And what happens in that is that characters show up. So in the second scene, after the boys have gone missing, Ava's at the police station and a character called Mary is sitting next to her and rubbing her back. Well, I didn't plan Mary at all. And then she starts telling this whole story to Ava. And I'm thinking, okay, this is odd. I'm just going to go with this, So it was just, and actually I feel like Mary did end up adding her perspective, added something really unusual and beautiful to the story, which I didn't expect.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, what do they say? No surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So, and I think it does. There's a freshness and energy to it when you're writing like that.
Yeah. So you ended up, I'm imagining, with a whole lot of words that you then had to condense down.
Yes.
Yeah. How did that revision process go for you? Like prior to actually submitting it to a publisher, did you work on that for a long time?
Was
it a long process?
It was. Yeah, it was. I won't lie about that. And that is where. Yeah. I mean, I think it's. Kevin Cody said good writing is rewriting, and that's, I think, really true. I think, I don't know if you're familiar with Kate Grenville's novel, The Idea of Perfection. I think she rewrote that 20 times. Ernest Hemingway rewrote Farewell to Arms 36 times, and that's standing up, doing it by pen at a lectern.
Wow.
So there's a kind of, that's the standard, I suppose. And so I kind of knew that would be the case, so what would happen is I'd give it out to a couple of trusted readers and they'd say, I don't know about this character, this doesn't really add anything, and you'd go, oh really, but I really love that bit.
And can so I please keep him?
Yeah, it is a bit painstaking, and then people will write back and they'll say, oh, I really don't like, so one of the characters that was very troublesome was Simon, who is, For listeners, he's a character who actually turns up at the scene of the accident and he helps. Mm. And then he's also on his way to Shearwater, and so he sort of ends up being sort of involved in Ava's story a little bit. But people kept asking me, what's his role? Why is he there? And I really had to think hard about that because I really liked him as a character. And in the end, I think Simon, for me, and I'm not sure how you found it as a reader, he's a witness.
Mm.
He's a witness to what's happening, and he, in some ways, he holds a slightly, like, while everyone else is so caught up in the drama, and he's caught up too, but he's also seeing it unfold. And in his sections, we get a slight step back from the immediacy of what is a very intense story.
Yeah. Yeah, like you say, he's removed from the actual core drama, but he's got his own dramas, of course, going on. So you do get that really interesting perspective of somebody who's troubled himself looking on to this, scene unfolding. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And as you say, he's on his way to Shearwater when, you know, he meets Ava and the accident happens. And geography and place are very important in the novel. Oh, they were quite strong and beautifully described. Can you talk a bit about, like, is Shearwater a real place? And if not, where was it based, you know, on? Mm. And just how that whole thing came together for you?
So Shearwater is a fictional town on the Great Ocean Road, but I spent a lot of my childhood summers in a tiny little place called Peterborough, which is not far from Port Campbell on the Great Ocean Road. And I loved those beaches so much. It's I don't know if you've been there, Pamela, but it is incredibly beautiful.
Like many years ago, yeah.
Yeah, golden, there's golden cliffs and a really wild sea. And so on a summer's day, it's breathtaking, all that gold and blue. But then it's often rainy there. It's in the Southern Ocean. So the, you know, next stop is this, you know, there's Tasmania, and then next stop is the South Pole. It's like, so there's winds are freezing. Mm-hmm. And then there's often sort of dark skies and rain, and it's a perfect Gothic setting, really. Mm-hmm. Like it's beautiful but brutal and treacherous. And when I went back to Peterborough, when I was riding Shearwater, I visited the beach where we grew up swimming, and I learned then that there was a sign saying this beach is unsuitable for swimming, which
oops.
I had spent seven summers swimming there, but it just, I realised, well, yes, that the waves are very, very big, and they drag, you know, you'd often get dumped, and, you know, that experience where you're dragged through the sand face down, and you feel like all that, the weight of all that water on top of you. And this to me felt very much like an amazing metaphor for the emotional life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a perfect backdrop for the story, you know, cause it has got that sense of treachery, I guess,
yes.
You know, and you never know what's coming next type thing. And the birds are a beautiful feature in the story too, and the sort of symbolism and the way you use the birds throughout the story. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the birds, the Shearwaters, spelt with an A though, but I introduced those later, and I think that's partly because in the drafting process, because I felt that I had created this story which was very emotional, intense and up close. You know, you're right in there with Ava panicking about the boys, or you're right in there with Max wondering what decision to take next. You know, he's you know, thrust into this situation where he's not sure. He's the one who's got to make decisions, him and Teddy. And it's all very immediate, and I wanted to just let some light and air into the text. By bringing it out. And I started thinking about the natural world, and the Shearwaters have one of the longest migrations in the world. They go all the way up to the northern, to the Bering Strait and back again. And actually their migratory path over the surface of the earth is in a sort of figure eight, and which is also the symbol of eternity. And I just thought, wow, there's something so incredible about that. And also that, you know, here we are with all our emotional life and consciousness, but somehow these rhythmic expressions, it's almost like the earth's consciousness. You know, there's this kind of these other processes going on, which are part of us as well.
Yeah.
But also just physically describing the perspective from the bird's point of view of being above the earth, you know, that we're not right down there in it all the time.
Yeah. So it's an even broader outside perspective, you know, you know, we're talking about the different perspectives of the characters, but then you get this really broad worldview almost, yeah.
Yeah. And also, you know, I mean, there's so much, you know, that we, in a sense, you know, we make these journeys out and come back, you know, that they come back to the same place every year. And there's something, we don't live in a very rhythmic way anymore, but I think there's something in us that yearns for that rhythm.
Yeah.
And that it's actually, we're all out of kilter, like what's going on in the on the planet right now with the pandemic. And of course, as we're speaking, there's the riots that are happening in the US, where it's, you know, we've been living these lives that have gotten increasingly busy. We're in front of screens the whole time. We're very disconnected from those natural rhythms. And I think it's important to reflect and reconnect with those rhythms in some way and realize that the planet we live on has a bearing on who we are.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed those beautiful descriptions of the place and the birds. And, of course, they're so beautifully reflected, I guess, in the cover, which is just gorgeous. You must have been so happy with that, were you?
Oh, a beautiful cover. It's just beautiful. So it's designed by the amazing Hazel Lamb at HarperCollins, and she's done some incredible covers. So I love her cover of The Lost Flowers of Alice.
Just divine. Yeah.
It's incredible. And she's got such an eye. And the way she's put this together, so this is the original artwork is by somebody called Sabrina Garassi. And she has these gorgeous sort of organic forms that float and kind of they suggest landscapes. But when you really look at them, I mean, they are landscapes, but they're sort of otherworldly as well. And then she sort of designed it beautifully with little, you know, holographic twinkles on the cover and stuff like that. It's gorgeous. I mean, couldn't be happier with it, really.
Yeah, it's really lovely. Just going back a little step from that before we get to the wrap up, what was the sort of submission process like for you? Did you spend a lot of time submitting to publishers?
It was very dramatic. by which I mean, I sent it out too early, back in sort of 2017 or something, and it wasn't really fully ready. But I thought it was, and this is again that thing of not knowing how much more can be done to make a piece of work really coherent. And it got, you know, got the good knockback. So, you know, over the last few decades, I've gone from bad knockbacks to good knockbacks, or just deathly silence has been one of the knockbacks. So I reworked it again, sent it out again. So I was sort of alternating between agents and publishers. And there came a point early last year where I had received another kind of knockback, and I thought, gee, am I barking up the wrong tree here? I just, something seems to not be working, and I'm not sure what's going on. I think it was interesting because it was actually, I almost just let it go. I think I just felt like, boy, I don't know if I've got the energy to keep going with this. And I had sent it to one last agent, and I sent her an email, and I sent you this a few months ago. Have you read it yet? No, not yet. You'll be the first to know when I do. And I remember this sort of surge of energy just going through me, just going, just get her to read it. Just get her to read it.
Please.
The email must have prompted her, because she got back to me the next day, 2 days later, and made me an offer. So that was incredible. But I was in bed with a cold, and I remember thinking, is this real? Is this real?
Is this really happening?
Yeah. But she's been fantastic. So I'm very, very lucky to have got a great agent finally, after many decades of trying. But it was interesting because my other people said, oh, you don't seem as excited as I thought you would be. And I think it's partly because, I mean, of course I was excited. I was delighted and thrilled. But there was a part of me which had just gone, if this doesn't work, I don't know if I'm going to keep going.
I'm out,
you know. And it is a hard industry. It really is a very difficult industry to penetrate. There's so many people writing books. The standard is very high. You know, there's lots of great books being written. But I would really encourage people to just, you know, tenacity does matter.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Leah, and all the best with the next one.
Thanks, Pamela.
Oh, Kel, there were just some questions I really, really wanted to ask Leah, particularly one question about the ending of the book, which I couldn't do, and I get that because it would have been a massive spoiler alert. But I did have a really good chat to Leah afterwards and got to ask my question about her ending. So unfortunately, I can't share that with listeners because, you know, it would be revealing the ending, but I really wanted to know about her mind process, I guess, and the editing process in choosing the ending that she did for the book. And for anyone that hasn't read it yet, it's one of those books that does have quite a shock ending. And I guess that's a big draw card for, you know, pulling people into the story and getting them to read the book. So, yeah, if you do like to have something to really lock your socks at the end of a book, this is definitely one to read.
Actually, it reminds me so much when you talk about this of the interview I did with Claire G. Coleman, because their book, Terra Nullius, also has a similar major twist. And the problem is about halfway through the book, this twist occurs and it changes your whole perspective of the book. And if you talk about anything to do with the second half after the twist occurs, you instantly give away the whole first half of the book. And it's so hard to have the conversation you want to have, because all you want to do is ask the writer how they made those choices and what it meant for them. But you can't do it because you can't give away any of the twists.
Exactly. And we do have a lot of readers who listen to us too. And so I get that. And it's obviously a big part of the, you know, promotion and marketing around a book when it has that sort of twist in it. But yeah, just really fascinating from a writing point of view. And, you know, great to talk to Leah about her transition from, you know, short story writing and how she's taken those skills and really honed them in this, you know, longer form piece of Shearwater. You know, you can really see the short story writer in the writing of this book.
And there's actually a lot of short story competitions going on at the moment, and COVID seems to have produced a few more. So speaking of that, I might actually go and put a few of those up on the website or on the Facebook so that people can have a little look at the short story competitions that are happening, because it is a fantastic entry point into writing and being able to find your voice and feel your way out. And being able to put an entire story into the shorter form makes it, like you've said before, it's a real challenge, and you can then build on that and draw it out. And quite a number of short stories have turned into long form books. So, yeah, that's really – a great episode to return from break with. I love it.
Yeah, it was. And Shearwater is doing really, really well. You know, I think people are out there gobbling it up. It's got a beautiful cover and, as I said, quite a riveting and beautifully written story. So it was a really good one to start back with, Kel.
And it's really good to be back, Pam. It was a nice break. We needed the break. I think we took on too much and got a little bit overwhelmed with all the episodes we were trying to record and edit and release, and all the grants we were trying to get to be able to pay our way with this kind of thing. And I think making the choice to break, it was hard, and I know it sort of put a bit of a pause on things for a little bit for people, and we're sorry about that, but it was necessary. We just had to stop to be able to get over that hump of just too much work.
Yeah, and look, we've got, like you say, the break has done us the world of good, as they say, and we have some fabulous episodes coming up. We've got quite a few book launch episodes coming out in the coming weeks, and some great chats with authors, including a wonderful chat I had with Favel Perret for Anatomy of a Novel for her beautiful book, There Was Still Love. So some really great writing craft stuff coming up in that one.
Yeah, I can't wait to edit that one. It's sitting in my to-do list, and, yeah, can't wait to get my teeth stuck in. But what I really want to talk to you about today, Pam, actually has nothing to do with your interview. For a change. It comes from a Facebook post that I saw in one of our private writing groups. So I'm not going to say who posted it, and I'm not going to say the group that we got it from, because I want to respect the privacy of this group. But it was a post that really highlighted to me what Australian authors are earning for their books. And frankly, it made me want to vomit. I was shocked. The range. Okay, so Pam, I want you like to seriously talk to me about this because you're the published author out there, right? So this is what.
Okay.
What is a reasonable amount to expect from a book advance, either from a big publisher or from a smaller publisher? So what I noticed was, and this is the bit that really shocked me, was that for YA and kids books, your average advance was about $1,000 to $3,000. That's it. And in Australia, for an adult fiction novel of any sort, or even a non-fiction or a memoir, you're looking at like $3,000 to $5,000 or $8,000 at the top end.
Mm.
That's atrocious. That is astonishing to me, given how much work and time goes into writing a book. How is that even plausible? How are writers existing in this country?
Well, the absolute truth is that very, very few writers, particularly here in Australia, live off their earnings. You know, you have to supplement your book publishing with other things. So that could be teaching, mentoring, editing, manuscript assessment, you know, speaking engagements, which is why, you know, COVID has hit so hard for many writers who do the speaking circuit and do festivals and things. But yeah, when you see the reality of what authors actually earn, it's actually quite shocking. And look, a big part of it here in Australia is because it's a much, much smaller market. You will have noticed that the advances for particularly the US, the UK, bigger, you know, populations are substantially higher.
Like into the 100,000, some
of
them.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think those advances that they're talking about at the moment from 1 to 3,000, and in some cases, publishers are no longer offering advances. It's purely a royalty-based scheme, which I'll talk about in a minute. But it has actually dropped, you know, from reading that thread and from my own experience of publishing, you know, when I was traditionally published that was going back. So my first book came out in 2012.
So you were earning on the higher end of an advance, weren't you, Pam? Because you're sitting around that sort of 5 to 8K range rather than that 1 to 3K range. And that is considered a high-end advance.
Yeah. I won't say exactly what my advances were, but back in when I was published, certainly between, say, 2012, 2016, my advances were higher than that again.
Mm.
And that was at the time quite common. And it's this thing, I mean, it was a really interesting thread to read because it's one of the unspoken things, you know, in publishing is what books, what advances that are out there, because, you know, then authors start to question, well, why haven't I received an advance like that? Why is my publisher, you know, so stingy? Why has that author in the same publishing house as me received such a big advance and mine was so much smaller? So it's always been something that has been very hush-hush. So it was really interesting. But I think the thing that a lot of people don't understand, certainly if you're in the writing industry, you would most likely understand this, but I think some newer writers wouldn't, and definitely a lot of readers wouldn't understand that what actually happens is, say you're given an advance, say of $3,000, like you say, well, let's go five. Say you get an advance. So you basically, the publisher says, yes, we want to publish your book. We'll give you an advance of $5,000. You usually get half of that on signing. So you'd get $2,500 when you sign the contract, and then you would get the other $2,500 on publication day. So that's, let's say, an upfront payment for, you know, the writing and publishing of the book. Obviously included in that is, you know, they're going to do the marketing and things like that, even though you are expected to do a lot of that yourself now as well. What then happens is that with every book sold, you as the author earn 10% of that sales price. So if your book sells for $30, you would get roughly $3. So say about $2.70, you know, in tax and stuff.
Is that all?
Per book. Yeah. Yep.
Wow. Okay.
Once you sell enough books for all those amounts of $2.70 to add up to your $5,000, that's what's called earning out or earning out your advance.
Okay, so I was going to ask you about this because that was a term that kept coming up again and again. Mm. And a lot of people were saying, I'd rather have a smaller advance and earn out quickly than to have a big advance that I'm never going to earn out. And that was a whole other question. Yes, go.
Yeah, so the reason for that, so if you sell enough books to earn out your advance, basically the publisher has said in paying you that $5,000, they've said, we think you're going to sell, or we trust or hope that you're going to sell $5,000 worth of books, right? Or that amount of books, $2.70 is going to amount to that, right? I don't know what the number is there, but that's basically what they're saying in giving you that amount. So then once you've earned that $5,000 back, every book that you sell after that is then a royalty for you. So each year you'll get a royalty statement, usually twice a year, where all those additional $2.70s that add up, you then get, you know, so you might get $30, or you might get $500, or you might get $5,000, depending on how many books are sold. Okay.
Mm. Now that's different to lending rights and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah,
there's
a
whole other thing with public lending and things as well, isn't there, where you get extra royalties. Okay, so this is purely based on sale of book royalties.
Sale of book and payment from the publisher. So when some people were saying they'd rather get a smaller advance, the reason for that is that when you get the advance, you get that advance regardless of whether you sell enough books to earn that, you know, to earn it out or not. So say you got a $5,000 advance, but you only sold enough books, say in the first, I don't know, they like to look at it in the first few months, but I mean, realistically, let's say the first year or so. If you only sold enough books to add up to $2,500, you don't have to pay anything back. You keep all that money. But what the message, I guess, that the publisher gets then is, well, we've paid you $5,000, but you've only earned back half of that amount. So the book hasn't sold enough to justify
the investment.
I guess, the investment that we've put into you.
So it reflects on their investment.
Yeah. So that doesn't mean that they won't sign you for another book, but it sort of puts you on a little bit of shaky ground. Do you know what I mean? Like that somebody else, another author might come along that has a book that they think is going to be more successful, more popular, they're going to be able to sell more copies. They may not re-sign you. Mm. But hear about bidding wars and publishers coming in and, you know, auctioning, books being put up to auction for publishers. And, you know, people can get up, you know, like 50,000, 100,000 sort of advance. That's a lot of money to earn back, and it's a lot of pressure on the author to sell that many books. Not that you're personally selling them, but you know what I mean? Like there's that stress that, oh, like if I have a $100,000 advance and I only sell, you know, $30,000 worth, what's going to happen? Are they going to want to publish another book?
Mm.
So often it is better to get a smaller advance. You might have more hope of selling that out. And then, you know, then you would receive, you'd still be paid. You'd still receive royalties on top of that. But the other thing is that the diminishing amount in advances that has happened over the last few years. So, you know, with the closure of bookshops, with, I don't know, more pressure on the whole industry, publishers seem to be offering much lower advances now than they had previously.
And much less marketing support. So not only are they lowering the advances so that, you know, authors can't actually live off their writing, but they're also like reducing the marketing support, which we actually talked about in another episode last year, I think. We were saying how I think you said you'd watched it shrinking down to like now a period of maybe 4 weeks, which is why we felt so badly for everyone in COVID-19 when we realized, oh my goodness, authors can't launch their books anymore, and they only have this tiny window of time when a publisher backs them in there, especially if they're a new author, to be able to get out there and get in the face of readers. And publishers have already contracted that time down to as tight as they can, put all that responsibility on the authors, and now they're not even paying the authors in the first instance. And like it, you, for example, when I got my website built, I guess, no, it's different, isn't it? So I guess that's me going to someone for a service and I'm paying them, because I was going to say, yeah, I pay them like half of it up front and then I paid, you know, the other half when it was complete. But no one would come to me. Like, I would never be able to go to a web designer and say, can you just like do most of this for the smallest amount of money? I know it's going to take you months and lots of hours of work, and you potentially might have to put in the cracks of your life or push other stuff back. But we're not going to pay you for that until later, until we can sort of see where we think it might fit. That there's no other place apart from the arts where people expect everyone to put in all that effort for nothing, and then there's no guarantee at the end of it. It really is a labor of love, like something that people, an imperative, they have no choice but to do. Because why else would you do it?
Good question.
Do you think, Pam, like, you're the author? I'm not the author. I'm just the shocked reader.
Why do you do it? Yes, this is something I often ask myself.
Okay, Pam, there is so much more to this conversation than I thought that we were going to uncover today, and I don't want to stop. So what I'd like to do, because I know that this is going to go for probably a good hour, so what I would like to do is say pause to everyone out there. We're not going to finish this conversation on this episode. We're going to leave it here. We will release the full conversation on this topic about authors earning money and the rates that they're earning and indie publishing and traditional publishing and all of that as a bonus episode when we release this Leah Swan interview. So go into the feed and you should find it as the next episode there, and you can hear the whole conversation, because Pam goes right into getting international representation, talking in depth about indie publishing versus traditional publishing. And we really start to get into the nitty-gritty of some of this stuff, because I don't know it and this post made me want to know it. So we're going to stop here. Should we end it there?
We should, probably.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Rights for Women podcast. If you enjoyed listening, we would really appreciate it if you could head over to wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating or review so that other people can find us too. If you want to hear more brilliant conversations with great writers, you can head to our website, www.rightsforwomen.com, where you can catch all the episodes from the Convo Couch and the Anatomy of a Novel series, as well as the Book Launch, a season of episodes created to help authors launch their books in isolation.
And while you are there, why don't you check out our Patreon page? Patreon is how people can support the artists making the work they love. So if you love Rights for Women and want to support us in supporting other authors, become a Patreon subscriber and get some cool little bonuses while you're at it. To everyone who is already a subscriber, we appreciate your passion for our project and thank you very much. You can always find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well. Thank you for staying home and supporting our authors. This podcast episode was produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.